Thank you, everybody. So this session is going to be divided between kind of two different parts. I'm going to begin by talking about some of the technologies that already exist when it comes to biometrics, when it comes to the distinguishable characteristics around our bodies and our physical traits. But then we'll be discussing also kind of soft biometrics, the things in which that maybe our typing patterns or other things in which there are kind of telltale signs that are able to, that observers are able to actually assign with, and sometimes with startling high confidence, characteristics about us, even if it might be anonymized data or other sort of kind of separated or disambiguated capture systems. When Adam and I were preparing this talk, he had said something along the lines of, you know, we're just about 10 minutes away from an episode of Black Mirror. I would say that we're already 10 minutes through an episode of Black Mirror. The state of biometrics, capture systems, particularly things like facial recognition technologies, but also fingerprint recognition, iris scans, is progressing incredibly fast. I'm just going to take a few minutes to run down three sort of aspects and arenas in which these technologies are being used in, and just kind of give a kind of a state of the surveillance. Start out with governments. The last session we were talking a little bit about national IDs and the ways in which that countries like India are now have a biometric national ID system, the ADAR system. This is 1.2 billion people. We're now talking about with India and the sort of kind of biometric systems that are being installed in China. Now we're talking 2.5 billion people on the planet now are inside of kind of these regimes that are becoming more and more dependent upon not just biometrics, but also having automated decision making create output for what certain citizens are and are not allowed to do, access, travel, and other things. So there was Wired had an interesting piece today. In Wales, they've been experimenting with facial recognition scans. It's also been taking place in China, where they'll scan massive crowds of people and look for ID, positive ID matches for known criminals, people that are wanted from the law. A facial recognition system was basically run on the crowd attending a Champions League game in Wales, and kind of the postmortem of this, they found that there was 92% of matches were incorrect. Another event at an Elvis concert in Wales, 17 individuals were spotted that the system said were persons of interest. Seven of those were misidentified. We now have 5 million refugees with biometric information collected from the UNHCR. There's the UNHCR tent outside. They're one of their identity management managers is attending Republica and gave some very interesting statistics about kind of what they're doing for some of the world's most vulnerable populations. So we're seeing different things where maybe India is mandatory in the sense of you go to a place and have your fingerprints taken. Refugees for UNHCR as well. China is actually rolling out some very interesting systems using not just facial recognition but voice print technology. So there is a Anhui-based company called iFlyTech, and what they are doing is their products are now coming preloaded on millions of Chinese mobile phones. And in order to get a SIM card, you need to register with an ID. And so this is kind of a point in which they are able to match a real-life identity with a digital service. The quote from the GM of this company says they work with the public with the Ministry of Public Security to pin down the criminals. Well, this is for voice recognition, and they have amassed a database of 70,000 voice patterns. What it's doing is it's there's services now in Anhui province that will basically have automated voice recognition technology rolled out to scan voices to look for matches and voice prints with those of wanted criminals. So a lot of the technology, or in one aspect, the technology that we're seeing, the way that biometrics is being rolled out is in the name of public security, public safety. We've seen kind of after September 11th, the way in which kind of the, how states can really swing to kind of their most authoritarian roots when it comes to things like anti-terrorism and public security. Also, things going on in China, that there are 70 million CCTV cameras up and running, with 400 million new cameras being installed over the next 3 years, according to a recent report by the BBC. Right now, these systems, there are systems with 1.8 billion photographs of faces. Everyone entering and exiting China will have their face put into a system. That means 320 million photos from borders alone. So I think on one hand, where maybe we're excited in some ways about the GDPR providing additional or codifying rights for individuals in Europe, in other places in the world, the kind of Black Mirror episode is well underway. Starting this month in May, China will start banning people with poor social credit from planes and trains. So now we're seeing this kind of these stacks of personal identity in which my personal mobility is restrained from a technological rubric that comprises things like a social credit score, but also the identification factor here is my face. So I can be picked up in a crowd. I can go to buy a train ticket, and the camera sees me and does not let the person issue me a ticket. On the corporate side of things, there's also a lot of biometrics being deployed. Some examples of this: JetBlue and Delta Airlines are now rolling out facial recognition systems to speed up boarding. KFC in China is using facial recognition to serve customers. Reebok, the shoe brand, has face detection software installed in its New York store now. One of the things, though, that not all systems are created equal. Adam will be discussing in a few minutes about the limitations of technology, but also the ways in which that there's new advancements that are right around the corner that allow a single device to be able to tell more about us than meets the eye. Some of these the systems have been shown also, due to the training data that's used, that perhaps white men are more common in the databases and the test and training data than black women. And so these systems are good at identifying white men, but when it comes to people that do not, that look differently, that they have a lower rate of positive identification. And so I'm going to turn it to Adam here in a moment, and we'll come back at the end, but I think it's important for us to realize that these systems already exist, that they are being rolled out by corporations. Actually, I wanted to touch on one more thing, and that was the health industry. That right now there's already research going into looking at things like running image recognition on facial recognition on Instagram photos to diagnose for depression. As we are creating these new technologies, there's very little oversight and regulatory control. And once we've already put out 10 years of digital social media, we never perhaps thought that Facebook would be running facial recognition algorithms on us and those in our photos to be able to try to extrapolate new trends. So I think that as we're talking about the technologies, there's almost this retroactive nature in which the old CCTV footage can be ingested into image recognition databases. And so as far as the technologies, right around the corner, turn it over to Adam to freak us out a little more.
Thank you. Uh, Thank you all for coming. I don't exactly want to freak you out. I think that one of the outcomes of doing that is a lot of the times a fatalistic perspective of this technology. We end up becoming overwhelmed with everything that computer vision can know about us and that everything people can do with that information. So to dig deeper and to try to avoid that inevitable fatalistic perspective, I want to propose thinking about it as just visual information. The same way we think about digital information passing over Wi-Fi, what if we just consider a camera to be kind of like a Wi-Fi router, but in a different part of the electromagnetic spectrum? So not to be too anti-romantic about photography, which I admire as an art, but if you think technically about what's happening, these are both capturing and transmitting information within a region of the electromagnetic spectrum. And what that looks like, to us it's so familiar because this is where we live. We live in the visible spectrum. Outside of that, we have spectral bandwidths that we're familiar with, like FM radio, Wi-Fi, infrared, ultraviolet, or X-rays. But when data moves outside of our perceptual bandwidth, we treat it differently. And why do we do that? Because if you think about it technically, it's all a continuous spectrum of information. Then to look into what can be captured with a camera, thinking about it more as a data transceiver, a receiver, capturing that data, start with just one pixel, which is a very boring amount of information. You can hardly see it, you can't really do much with it. But actually, there's a lot that you can contain in one pixel. You can actually encode every letter of the Times New Roman font set with 99% separability. That means you could write a book, and each letter could be one pixel. So you have the same amount of diversity in one pixel that you have an entire font set. Now, if you go to only 2x2 pixels, you can think about this as a very small database. But if you do 256 to the fourth, so grayscale values, we end up with 4.2 billion values that could be stored at 2x2. What happens when we go up to 4x4? So now we have 256 to the 16th, which is 3.4 teraiota values. It could be stored at 4x4. Then we get to 8x8, and you end up with 13.4 giga yada 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 values, or 256 to the 64th. That's a massive amount of information in a negligible size of an image. So what are people doing with that in the computer vision industry? Well, you can do with 40 people, you can do 100% accurate facial recognition with a very simple neural network. When you pixelate that image to 12 by 14 pixels, 168 total pixels, it only goes down to 98.75 accuracy. You can go down even further. You can get it to 6 by 7 pixels, and the accuracy drops to 98.75, which is the same as before. Which is to say that you can do a lot with a little when it comes to visual information. And here's a research paper that shows how maybe if you are operating a surveillance camera for something like activity recognition or people counting, maybe you don't need to store 1080p video. Because if you're only doing pedestrian counting, you only need 168 pixels, a 12 by 16 image. I think when we talk about face recognition, we talk about computer vision, we're using a language that was constructed before the rush in the development of AI and computer vision ways of perceiving and understanding the world. So what exactly does a face mean? This is kind of an obvious question. Everybody knows what a face is. We all have one. But what if I asked you to put into writing specifically, what are the boundaries of that face? Where would you draw the edges of a box? What resolution would you limit a face to? And there are varying definitions. So in the last slide, NIST recommends between 40 and 300 interocular pixels for their facial recognition vendor test carried out in 2017. According to another definition by American National Standards Institute, International Committee for Information Technology Standards, they recommend 90 interocular pixels, as does the ISO IEC passport specification published in 2005. And it seems like this has been updated according to the paper I just mentioned, facial recognition vendor test by NIST. Now they've increased that to 120 interocular pixels. You can basically double that to get the resolution of the face. So you're looking at a face, according to passport regulations, is 240 pixels. But it doesn't define the bounding box still, so we don't have a concise definition. But going through these papers, you can estimate that in some cases it's a lot less. So using the software for the facial recognition vendor test, most of the data sets that they're using are between 20 and 55 interocular pixels. So actually the passport is much larger. And after looking at a lot of data sets and a lot of these papers, it kind of resolves around 100 interocular pixels, or around 200, and that would be the bounding box for a face. So no one has agreed on this, but this is kind of, you know, in my own observation, this is what a face is being treated as right now. Here's the problem. A lot of people have been sold on facial recognition for everything from monitoring jaywalkers to security applications. This technology has really been trained on celebrity photos, high-resolution celebrity photos from professional photographers. And it does not reflect the real-world accuracies of facial recognition. This is a paper that came out this year, which shows that the accuracy in the real world is far, far lower, on the order of 25.8%. So when the facial recognition companies are offering their product, they're typically quoting accuracy based on this one very biased data set called LFW, or labeled faces in the wild. And it's kind of a cheater's benchmark, because these photos are all from the web. They don't reflect real-world surveillance conditions. So here's the switch, is that now companies need to upgrade. If they want true accuracy in the real world, what they already bought doesn't cut it anymore. So that 200 pixels for a face, now there's going to be a lot of reason for companies to say, yeah, we don't want 25.8 accuracy. We want, you know, 60% accuracy or 80% accuracy like you promised us before. And the next step is that data sets will grow in resolution. And here's the first example of that from a research paper about 2 weeks ago. Researchers introducing the first 4K high-resolution data set. And the problem here is what happens when you have 4K face captures. Well, you're basically getting into a medical scan of somebody's face. So let's look at where cameras are heading. 120 megapixel consumer level camera. And the research coming out of computer vision and neural networks, which is able to identify skin lesions and basically do a medical diagnosis. So when you increase the resolution to a certain degree, you go into the medical world. So this is one concerning trend, and I think a strong reason for considering a resolution-based regulation of facial recognition. One of the other trends along the lines of resolution is looking from a different angle, is looking from space. First, consider this study from Stanford that is able to infer race from the car parked outside of your house captured on Google Street View. If you look into the correlation between the type of car and an Asian demographic, we see typically Asian automobiles. When we look into the research paper, we can see cars that are associated with a white demographic. And here's the crazy part. Another company called RS Metrics is able to do car recognition from space. So they're a satellite imagery analytics provider, and they offer insights to Wall Street, typically, and they'll be able to say, well, we know how many cars were parked at the Walmart parking lot, or we know how many cars are being output by the Gigafactory at Tesla. So they can actually recognize the model of that car. And if you combine those two together, you basically have the capabilities to recognize race from outer space. Going further with the trends, thinking now in terms of spectral bandwidth resolution, there are some neural network research papers that are looking at how to jump. So how to do bandwidth jumping. If you capture somebody's face in thermal, can you synthesize the face invisible or vice versa? And that means we could turn off the lights and nobody would know who's recording who. You could capture someone's face and then you could synthesize what they looked like in the visible spectrum. Faces, I would say, are hyperbiometric. They contain many different biometrics when you have enough resolution. You have the basic, the visible capture, the way that we're looking at people, kind of the structural elements of a face, the broad understanding of it. But you also have infrared, and now you have vein recognition in infrared. With enough resolution, a face contains eyes. So a face is part of an iris recognition workflow. You have thermal, and that thermal can be synthesized into visible. I've seen this tongue. You can actually do a lot of analytics if somebody posts a photo with their tongue out on social media. And this kind of leaves us with a question, can it be regulated if we don't know what we're regulating? So we could say we want to regulate facial recognition, but in that proposal for regulation, are we including things that we don't yet know? And that's very difficult or not quite possible. So in my proposal, conceptual proposal for how to think about this, it's kind of an axis of optics. How can we plot, how can we measure all of the different hyperdimensional biometrics of a face and not think in terms of a legacy terminology of a face, but think in this more updated understanding that a face does contain many sub-biometrics, which each on their own could be used to recognize someone, but in totality make a very robust and accurate biometric that can be used to recognize people remotely, passively, and without their cooperation. Then I'll leave it there, and back to you.
There's still 5 minutes, so if somebody has questions.
Yes, I think that you can start hand somebody a microphone, and can I just maybe one last thing?
Stay tuned for this last slide. Something that Adam and I have been talking about, but this concept that Adam's working on, I don't know. Maybe it's one way to try to save the future. So I don't know. I think it's a really interesting and provocative proposal. A couple of other just quick kind of regulatory remedies that I kind of want to run through besides the spectrum frequency. Perhaps the idea of a standard definition of a face pegged to something like an 80 by 80 interocular pixels, but some have some sort of standard definition. What are we, when we say face, when it comes to a global policy rollout of regulations, a standardization there. Perhaps increased scrutiny for the deployment of multimodal biometric systems. perhaps compliance when it comes to an ombudsman of biometrics for different levels of governance. Maybe we have people from other for other industries. Perhaps biometrics is something that needs kind of an outside regulator. And perhaps even when it comes to being able to buy and sell biometric databases, perhaps we need a higher scrutiny. Are they not just simple commodities in the sense they can't be revoked or reissued? Is that a question? We got one time for one question? I think we got time for one question, yeah. Yeah, one question.
Yep. Hi, Jan Keller. You mentioned the risks of the screening from governments and even from space. Do you have a dimension? We have our mobile phones in our pocket with face recognition, like Apple and Samsung, they introduced it. Do you know how they store their data? Do you know what they are doing with them? Or do you know what the risks can be with this issue?
I think the biggest risk with face recognition on your own device is the normalization that occurs of the technology. But according to Apple, the data is stored locally. And the main difference here is that it's a cooperative biometric. So when I capture your face without you knowing, that's a non-cooperative biometric. And when you capture it yourself, it's called a cooperative. And these are real different ways to look at the issues with biometrics. Of course, it becomes very incentivized when you have it on your own because you want to authenticate yourself to get access to your phone or to get money from a bank and so on. And so you end up forcing people to be cooperative. So it turns into a gray area there, I think.
And I think on this point of the normalization, I mean, now iPhones have face scanners, but no headphone jacks. And I think there's this kind of, there is a will by corporations to be able to kind of channel us into, to not be able to have, to not make the capture of our biometrics choices. And even if it's still stored locally, will it always be? Is this actually a secure? What is the strongest encryption it can be stored with? And one day, could it be susceptible to future vulnerabilities?
Yeah. Thank you, Matthew.
Thank you very much.
And thank you, Adam, although it's not very calming. Thank you for your talk. And...